the world's great novels. Though Wilkie Collins was by no means the first English novelist to trace the influence of circumstance upon character, present-day writers of detective fiction have learned much from his uncanny gift for creating suspense by innuendo, and from the effortless technique with which he heightened the inevitable steps of a relentless fate. The National Broadcasting Company now presents the third episode in its four-part dramatization of The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins, another in the series of books that live, the world's great novels.
Better had the moonstone, that yellow diamond of evil memory, remained encrusted in the forehead of the Hindu idol from which it was stolen centuries ago, than become, despite its immense value, a possession of the Verinder family, whom I, Gabriel Betteridge, served as house steward for most of my life. A very happy life indeed, until the coming of the curse of the moonstone. Well do I know the Moonstone's tragic story. Yet sometimes in the telling of it, I find myself relying on the testimony and knowledge of others. Therefore, to those most concerned, I make humble apology, yet pointing out that the role of narrator falls to myself, not by choice, but from necessity. And now, streaming back into memory is that awful moment when, with Sergeant Cuff, England's most famous private criminal investigator, I stood at the lonely, shivering sand, listening to the thunder of an angry sea which had just claimed a life.
Gabriel, I'm afraid there's no hope. Rosanna Spearman is dead. Her footprints lead straight to yonder ledger-jutting rock.
She's fallen into the quicksand, lost forever. The quicksand will never give it up.
Yes, there's nothing to keep us here. Come, we'd best return to the house of your mistress, Lady Verinder.
Hardly had Sergeant Cuff and I turned back up the slope of the beach when, running swiftly toward us, came one of the grooms who placed in my hands the first of a series of fateful messages which were to arrive at intervals in the troubled months to come.
Speak up, man. What does the letter say?
It is written in the hand of Rosanna Spearman.
Ah, read it, man.
Yes. Yes.
When you next see the shivering sand, Mr. Betteridge, try to forgive me once more. I have found my grave where my grave was waiting for me. I've lived and died, sir, grateful for your kindness.
Now, Gabriel.
Don't touch me, sir. You drove her to it.
Control yourself, you man. Control yourself.
Very well, Sergeant Cuff. Let us proceed back to the house. My mistress, Lady Verinder, will be extremely anxious to face you.
Sergeant Cuff, you alone are responsible. Rosanna Spearman was innocent, and you frightened her into taking her own life. You and your infernal spying. Gabriel, give this wretch whatever money he requires and release me from the sight of him.
Yes, my lady.
Believe me, Lady Verinder.
Before you begin, Sergeant Cuff, I have no wish. I regret if my words have wronged you.
Your ladyship is most kind. You are a good and gracious person.
Sir, I thank you.
In connection with the suicide of Miss Rosanna Spearman, I have this to say before I withdraw from the case. You have indeed dispensed with my services, have you not? I see. Then, Both you and Gabriel have assigned a motive for the suicide of Rosanna Spearman, which I deny is true. She took her life because of some connection with the Moonstone. Some unbearable anxiety about the stolen gem led to her self-destruction. And I know the person capable of deciding whether I'm right or wrong.
I see, Sergeant. And is that person now in the house?
She has left the house, milady.
Do you refer to my daughter, now visiting her aunt in town?
I most certainly do.
I had hoped you would go without mention again of my daughter's name. So you would make me believe my daughter Rachel stole the jewel, which was indeed her own?
Yes. From the very first, she was hostile to all questioning. The only one to refuse to have her wardrobe examined in my search for the paint smeared nightgown.
The circumstances have misled you, Sergeant.
Then there's this circumstance. I told Miss Rachel her departure would put obstacles in my way of recovering the Moonstone. In the face of that statement, you yourself saw her leave. If Miss Rachel is not trying to interfere with the recovery of the Moonstone, what does it mean?
I don't know. I wish I knew.
And let us return for a moment to poor Rosanna. Before she became your housemaid, she was a convicted thief, having relations, to my certain knowledge, with a most notorious moneylender in London. And I believe Rosanna became your daughter's unwilling accomplice.
But why? In God's name, why?
Miss Rachel, in need of a great sum of money she must raise privately and secretly, might have stolen the Moonstone. And with the aid of Rosanna Spearman, have sold it to the moneylender Rosanna had trafficked with in the past.
Preposterous, no.
Then may I tell your daughter, and without warning, this news of Rosanna's suicide, so that I may shock her into a confession. Do I have your ladyship's consent?
You have my consent, Sergeant.
When may I confront her?
No, no, you may not.
Well, but, milady, just a moment.
Shall do it myself. Yes, as boldly as you would, sir.
But I am soon to leave for London. How shall I know the result?
You shall know before you leave. Good day, Sergeant Cuff.
Still no word from her.
You shall hear from my mistress, Sergeant, as she promised.
In all my experience, this without a doubt is the most trying investigation I ever attempted to conduct. But it's time now to meet my train. So let me, in farewell, Gabriel, tell you of three things which will happen in the future.
Three things?
Item one. News of Rosanna will come from the Yollands, her friends, the fisherfolk.
And the second?
The three Indians who attempted to steal the Moonstone will be heard from again, in connection with the Verinder family.
And?
News will come of the notorious moneylender connected with Rosanna Spearman in the past. I suggest you write his name down. Mr. Septimus Luker, Middlesex Place, Lambeth, London.
Septimus Luker.
That's right.
Middlesex Place, mm-hmm. Lambeth. As I repeated Cuff's words, Lady Verinder's message arrived. The report of her interview with her daughter in town.
What did she say?
Lady Verinder is pleased to state that her daughter was shocked at the news of Rosanna's suicide, but adds she had never spoken a single word in private to the poor girl from the very moment she entered service in this house. Further, Miss Rachel also swears she is in debt to no living creature. What does the great Sergeant Cuff say to that?
What do I say? As I leave you, sir, I say I failed. Completely.
The day following the departure of Sergeant Cuff, I had much to do. Lady Verinder and Miss Rachel had to be packed off in a hurry to their townhouse in London. And Mr. Franklin Blake, the headstrong young suitor Miss Rachel still refused to see, also left, heartbroken, for a long stay on the continent. The house was now empty, save for a few servants and myself. Then, late that afternoon, the first of Cuff's prophecies came true. Why, it's Lucy Yallon.
And where's the man calling himself Franklin Blake?
Blake? Gone abroad. Why?
I have something for him. Why, a letter.
A letter? From Rosanna Spearman?
Aye. A letter from that sweet, lovely girl to her murderer.
Hand it over, Lucy. I'll send it to him.
You'll not. I hate him. Oh, she was so dear and sweet, she was. And she said I was to give it to him and no other one. Should he ever return this Franklin Blake, it'll be my pleasure to hand him the message from the dead myself.
Then shortly after, another of Cuff's predictions came true. A news clipping from a London paper sent by Cuff himself.
Mr. Septimus Newcastle, the well-known money lender and dealer in gems, reported to the police that he has been annoyed by three Indians hanging about his shop. He asked police to protect him against further annoyance.
I had no way of knowing if Cuff's third prediction, that the Indians would turn up at the Verinder home in London, had also become a fact. But soon there came news from which I have never recovered. I refer to the sudden death of my dear Lady Verinder, Rachel's mother. Months crawled by, alone in the stately house. No matter what room I entered, she was there. Her spirit hung over all, like the lingering scent of primrose in spring. One day, as I sat in the garden with my beloved copy of Robinson Crusoe on my lap, there suddenly appeared before me...
Gabriel, my old friend.
Oh, Lord bless me.
How are you, Gabriel?
Why, it's Mr. Franklin Blake himself. How are you, my dear boy?
Oh, well enough, I suppose. But in times gone past, I've been much better.
You've heard about Lady Verinder, sir?
Yes, I came back to England the moment I knew. I tried to see Rachel again, but to no avail.
Oh? Then what brings you here, Mr. Blake?
The Moonstone.
Oh, let the diamond be. Take my advice, Mr. Blake. That cursed Indian jewel has been the ruination of everyone who's come near it. Forget the past.
No, I cannot. I am determined to get to the bottom of it. Rachel believes I had something to do with its theft. My salvation can come only by unmasking the criminal who did make off with the Moonstone. Oh, if there were something, one little clue to point to the trail I must follow.
Wait.
You will help me, can you?
Shortly after you left to go abroad, Lucy Allen came here with a letter she said was for you.
A letter?
Yes.
Whom was it from?
Rosanna Spearman.
Rosanna?
Apparently it had been written shortly before she passed away.
Oh, yes.
Shall we visit Lucy and receive Rosanna's letter?
Oh, yes, let us go at once.
Never shall I forget the horrible things the crippled Lucy Garland said to Mr. Blake before she handed him Rosanna's letter, which he turned over to me. Through brimming tears, I read of a young girl's tragic affection for a man who could not love her because he loved another. And then on another slip of paper, inside the envelope, in Rosanna Spearman's hand...
Go to Shivering Sand at the turn of the tide. Walk out on the rock of South Spit. Follow a direct line from the Coast Guard station. And then bend down on a very ledge of rock. And you will feel among the seaweed a chain. Pull that chain.
Have you found the chain, Mr. Blake?
No, not yet.
She said to reach down into the seaweed.
Wait, there is something here.
Huh?
Yes, it is a chain with something attached to it. Something which dangles just beneath this ledge of rock.
Pull it up, pull it up.
Not so tight.
Why?
Wet.
It's a tin box.
Yes.
The very one Rosanna bought for Mrs. Yallon just before she died. Open it.
I will. This lid is... It's clamped on so secure.
What is inside?
Appears to be some kind of linen. Take it out, Gabriel.
Why? It's a nightgown. And look,
There, just below the monogram, a paint smear. Sergeant Cuff said the nightgown of the person who stole the moonstone will be smeared by paint. But whose nightgown is it? I can't recall ever having seen it before.
I have seen it before. Indeed, I have worn it. Gabriel, this nightgown is mine.
Shaken to his soul by the discovery of the accusing nightgown, and convinced that he himself had stolen the moonstone, Franklin Blake paced the floor as nervously as a cat.
But, Gabriel, how could I have stolen the moonstone without knowing it? Why, it's fantastic. How could I have done it?
I don't know, Mr. Blake. Perhaps you were drunk.
Oh, no.
Or walking in your sleep when you took the jewel. And if you did take the moonstone, where is it now?
Oh, my mind is completely blank, Gabriel. Let me see now. Who else was present at Rachel's birthday party the night the moonstone vanished?
Dr. Candy, for one.
Yes.
He lives nearby in Frizinghall. Oh, but in the past year, he's failed considerably. Can't even seem to remember where he left his collar button. I doubt he can help you very much.
Nevertheless, I'm bound to have a try at it. Dr. Candy must help me.
Sorry, Mr. Blake. Sorry. I remember a little of what happened that night. You see, that same evening when I returned home from Lady Verinder's, I was taken suddenly ill. My memory isn't quite what it should be, sir, I'm afraid. It's a bit off, it is.
Thank you, Dr. Candy. You've been most kind.
Not at all.
Well, I guess I'd better be getting back. Good night, Doctor.
Good night.
That's that.
Ah, Mr. Blake, huh? I believe.
Well, who are you? Is it your custom to sneak up on a man?
My apologies, Mr. Blake. People hereabouts will tell you Ezra Jennings is not the most popular of men. I am Dr. Candy's assistant.
Oh.
And you can see my appearance is hardly in my favor and does little to win me friends. My gypsy complexion and fleshless cheeks remind some persons of another like myself. Only he has horns.
You are very sensitive.
I am very. I imagine you find Dr. Candy greatly changed.
Oh, yes, terribly. His memory has been gravely affected.
It's been failing for nearly a year. On his way home from the birthday party at Lady Verinder's, he was caught in the rain and became violently ill. In fact, delirious.
Delirious, you say?
Indeed. He raved at great length. My curiosity became aroused. I took notes, quite unintelligible, of course, of what he said.
Mr. Jennings, in these wanderings of Dr. Candy, did he mention my name?
Yes, Mr. Blake. At one point, he did. His mind seems to have been occupied with something between himself and you.
And you say you have taken notes of his wanderings, what he said in his delirium.
Yes, Mr. Blake.
Then you will let me examine these notes?
I'm afraid, sir, that is quite impossible. I am forbidden to disclose the words of my suffering master. Good night, Mr. Blake.
Mr. Jennings, please hear me, please.
I'm listening, Mr. Blake.
This is a matter concerning my honor. I have reason to believe I am a thief. That I, without knowing it, have stolen a most valuable diamond.
Without knowing it? Incredible. What? Wait a moment. Mr. Blake, you have suggested more to me than you suppose.
I don't follow you, Mr. Jennings.
Mr. Blake, have you ever been accustomed to the use of drugs?
Never in my life.
Then you are most fortunate, because in me you see a derelict. One become a slave to the drug habit.
Oh.
But you needn't be sorry for me. Mr. Blake, I am sorry for you. And I have changed my mind. I will let you see the notes I took the night Dr. Candy, my poor colleague, became ill.
Oh, good.
But first, I have a client critically ill and awaiting me. I shall return in 2 hours. At that time, we can dwell upon the subject of Dr. Candy's delirium, as well as other things. In 2 hours, Mr. Blake. Down, Mr. Blake.
Thank you.
Now to plunge straightway into what Dr. Candy spoke of during his critical illness. Here is a significant part of the memorandum I made.
Go on, Jennings.
Listen. Mr. Franklin Blake is clever and agreeable, but wants taking down a peg when he talks of medicine. He confesses he's been suffering from want of sleep at night. I tell him his nerves are out of order, that he should take medicine. He tells me that taking medicine and groping in the dark are one and the same thing. Now, Mr. Blake, did you have difficulty sleeping a year ago this time?
Yes, yes. I slept wretchedly. Dr. Canty had tried to get me to take some medicine, but I refused.
And on the night of the Verinder birthday party, how did you sleep? It is most important. Try and remember.
I do remember. I slept soundly like a top.
Then, Mr. Blake, I am convinced, absolutely convinced, from what Dr. Candy revealed in his delirium, that on the night the moonstone was stolen, you slept under the influence of a drug which Dr. Candy administered to you in secret.
I don't know. I can only follow your opinion, but...
Mr. Blake, are you the man to try a bold and daring experiment?
I will do anything to clear myself of the suspicion which rests upon me now.
Will you put yourself completely in my hands, be guided implicitly by my advice, even though it may expose you to the ridicule of fools?
Yes, I will. But what am I to do, Mr. Jennings?
We shall simulate the conditions. I refer to the physical appearances of the Verinder household as those conditions existed nearly a year ago. But the real experiment, sir, shall be conducted with you yourself playing the part of the innocent victim.
I don't quite follow you.
We shall duplicate, sir, your physical and mental condition on the night the moonstone disappeared. And then, just before you go to bed, a drug will be administered to you.
But why? Why should I be given a drug?
Why?
Yes, what will I do?
This, Mr. Blake. In the presence of witnesses whose testimony will be beyond all dispute, you shall steal the moonstone a second time.
Why, it was the maddest scheme ever heard out of the mouth of any man I had ever known. The very appearance of this person, Jennings, gave me the walking shudders. He stalked the house like a proprietary ghost. But, urged on by Franklin Blake, I kept hard at work, restoring all the furnishings of the empty house to their places and conditions as they were on the night of the robbery. Mr. Blake gave himself completely over to Ezra Jennings, who for all the world reminded me of a cat watching a silly mouse. And each day Mr. Ezra Jennings would note in his diary the decline under his careful suggestions in Mr. Blake's physical and mental condition.
June 18th. In keeping with my plan, and because Mr. Blake had at this time 1 year ago given up smoking cigars, I have now forbidden him to smoke. He is, as I hoped, becoming increasingly nervous and irritable. June 20th. The sooner the rooms are returned to their appearance as of the night in question, the better. Mr. Blake now grows more and more restless. June 23rd. Mr. Blake is overwrought, highly nervous, just as I need him to be. I myself now begin to feel the last and terrible effects of the dead habit to which I am enslaved. I pray for strength to carry on, for the happiness of others is at stake. 2 days more, and then the experiment.
Then came the fateful day of the experiment. The witnesses, as Jennings was pleased to call them, began arriving. First was Mr. Brough, the Verinder's family lawyer, and quite grumpy he was.
But this is madness, Gabriel, sheer madness. I am now and forever opposed to this so-called experiment.
And when the matter had been explained to Miss Rachel, my young lady of the house, she consented to come with her companion, Mrs. Merridew, who apparently did not quite comprehend the matter at hand.
At what time, Gabriel, is the explosion to take place?
And then, of course, there was Miss Rachel herself, who surprisingly could think to ask only...
Gabriel, how is Franklin, and when can I see him?
As the time for the experiment drew near, I was fairly beside myself with nervousness and concern for the welfare of Franklin Blake. But 11 o'clock finally came, and Mr. Blake was in bed. Under the direction of Ezra Jennings, I myself brought the drink to Mr. Blake, the drink to which had been added the drug. Mr. Blake drank deeply. Miss Rachel's sitting room was directly across the hall from Mr. Blake's bedroom. A piece of crystal had been placed in the drawer of the engine cabinet in Miss Rachel's sitting room to represent the moonstone where it had been seen last. The witnesses were Miss Rachel and Mr. Brough. Mrs. Merridew had since retired, and they took their places in the sitting room, watching the door and the engine cabinet. Jennings and I sat by Mr. Blake's bed. He lay there like a man struck insensible. Then Mr. Bruff tiptoed in, no longer able to restrain his impatience.
For heaven's sake, Jennings, when will the drug begin to work?
Say nothing. Go back to the sitting room. We shall not have too long to wait.
Mr. Bruff left. I looked at Franklin Blake. He had opened his eyes, and in them flamed something I had never before seen. The dew of perspiration appeared on his face, and he began to mumble. And then suddenly, Franklin Blake was up and out of bed, and though speaking as if in a trance, his words came quite distinctly.
Wish I'd never taken it out of the bank. It was safe in the bank. How do I know? The Indians may be hidden in the house. And besides, the moonstone isn't even locked up. It's in the drawer of Rachel's Indian cabinet. And the drawer doesn't lock. I'd better take a candle and go have a look at it. Oh, there's the candle. There it is. Moonstone. Indian cabinet. Rachel's sitting room.
And so, candle in hand, Franklin Blake moved heavily towards the sitting room. I crept after him as he walked straight to the engine cabinet. There he stopped and placed the heavy ornate candle holder atop the cabinet. And then he began opening and shutting one drawer after another.
The moonstone. Where is it? Where? There. I'll take it. Now, where's the candle? Oh, yes. Now, I'll go back. Can't move. Strange. Legs heavy. Everything heavy. Candle too heavy. Even moonstone can't carry.
Franklin, oh, my darling. Oh, my poor dear.
Franklin Blake had indeed taken the moonstone from the drawer of the Indian cabinet. But after it had fallen on the floor, who had picked it up?
Moonstone by Wilkie Collins is one of the world's great novels brought to you each week by the NBC University of the Air. Listen next week to the final episode of this four-part radio version of The Moonstone. And remember that your local public library can be a constant source of information and entertainment. To add to your enjoyment of this series, we recommend the Handbook of the World's Great Novels, which you may obtain by sending 25 cents to World's Great Novels, Post Office Box 30, Station J, New York 27, New York. That's Post Office Box 30, Station J, New York 27. The Moonstone is adapted for radio by Robert Saxon. The music was composed by Emil Soderstrom, and the orchestra was directed by Bernard Berquist. The entire production was under the direction of Homer Heck. Sherman Marks is featured as Gabriel Betteridge, and Charles Mountain as Franklin Blake. Rachel is played by Geraldine Kay, Lady Verinder by Alma Platt, and Rosanna by Ruth Shaines. Sergeant Cuff is played by Arthur Sedgwick, Ezra Jennings by Maurice Copeland, and Dr. Candy by Arthur Peterson. This is John Conrad. This program comes to you from Chicago and is a presentation of the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent station. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.